I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Transit in Kansas City could be in for a futuristic overhaul, from free city buses to a possible Hyperloop that could send commuters across the state in as little as 30 minutes. Our transit options are on the increase. Today, a look at the state of transportation in Kansas City. We'll see if a streetcar expansion is on the horizon, get an update on the Buck O'Neill Bridge, and ask about the money surrounding some of these big-ticket items. Then, overbearing parents might be hindering their kids' ability to thrive as independent adults. One psychologist explains why adulting classes are being offered in schools and why he's worried about the trend. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. No question that Kansas City is a car-driving town. What's the old stat? We have more miles of highway per capita here than any other large metro in the country. But signs are emerging that our town is starting to focus on modes of transportation very different from big highways. That means streetcars and free buses and, who knows, maybe something called the Hyperloop. Now a conversation about the state of transportation as KCUR continues its focus on topics of importance to the region as part of its State of Kansas City series. With us, Ron Acapul is Director of Transportation and Environment for the Mid-America Regional Council. Ron, welcome back.
Thanks, Steve. It's great to be here.
KCUR reporter and afternoon newscaster Lisa Rodriguez is doing double duty today. Lisa, nice to have you too.
Good morning, Steve.
Ron, give us some context here. Is Kansas City in the process of shifting, if even ever so slightly, away from highways to other forms of transportation?
I'd say, yeah. As you pointed out, we've really grown since World War II as a highway focused region. But I think a lot of the highway expansion needs have been addressed. Our big challenge there is going to be maintaining what we've got. Mm-hmm. And so we are shifting focus quite a bit to the missing modes that we haven't paid as much attention to over the last 50 years or so in the region. And those include public transportation, bikes and pedestrians, and the new technologies. We're going to be talking about the Hyperloop a little bit, but then things like scooters and autonomous vehicles are things that we're looking forward to in the future.
You know, Lisa, I can't help but notice we're talking about a lot of different transportation topics this morning, but new highways isn't one of them. Do you see more emphasis on alternative modes of transportation, as Ron is suggesting, and than we've seen in recent years?
I think certainly there is more focus on alternative modes of transportation, and at least, you know, people are conscious of the fact that maybe we don't need more cars on roads necessarily, and thinking about other ways to move people around. I will say there are some exceptions in Johnson County, for example, I-35 and 75th Street. They are considering, or they are going to add a lane of highway traffic there. So it's not, we're not fully there yet, but absolutely, I think part of every discussion about roads, there's also now a discussion about how to get people places without necessarily having them all in their own car.
And that 75th Street intersection remains a pretty big bottleneck on I-35.
Absolutely. For those commuting, you know, to and from Kansas City from Overland Park, it's probably a daily headache.
Well, let's talk about some of these alternatives to lots of concrete and more highways. One of them is a streetcar. Lots of people are waiting for federal funding to expand the streetcar south to the Plaza and UMKC, Ron. Is this the year we get that federal funding?
Maybe not. I think that this is the year we continue to do work on the preliminary engineering to kind of position the region to receive those funds.
We're not done with that yet, Ron?
We're not done with it yet, but the work that, I mean, I think the project itself is very highly rated by the Federal Transit Administration. I think the chances are really good. There aren't any other rail projects in the Midwest that are competing for these funds right now. So hopefully we'll see a capital improvement grant approved this year If not, it's really in line for funding next year.
Lisa, what's your sense? How does an expanded streetcar line change that system? I mean, how much more interest would citizens have in the streetcar if they could actually go 4 miles on those trains and the Plaza and UMKC are part of it rather than just a couple miles?
I think you're opening the door to a lot more ridership the closer you get to the Plaza and UMKC. I think the key there was connecting several entertainment districts in Kansas City. You've got the River Market, which brings a lot of people out on the weekends, and now it's connected to the Crossroads, connected to Union Station. I think bringing that to the Plaza and particularly to UMKC, where you have a lot of students kind of living in this area, I think it will be huge, particularly to see how development increases along that streetcar line. I think now we're thinking about the major entertainment districts, but I think things will start filling in between those as well.
So, Ron, go ahead. Yeah,
I'm just gonna jump in and say, I mean, Kansas City effectively has two downtowns with a central business district inside the downtown loop, stretching down to the Plaza, and so this idea of connecting those two really isn't that new. We've been doing transit planning to really connect those two major nodes of activity and economic activity together since at least the 1990s. And so it just makes a ton of sense to continue expanding the streetcar south.
So, Ron, it sounds to me like you're pretty bullish on the idea that Kansas City will eventually get that federal funding and that the streetcar will, in fact, be expanded.
I'm pretty confident about it. Our congressional delegation has been very supportive of the project so far. As I said, on its merits, it's a good one. The performance of the downtown streetcar has certainly lended a lot of credibility to the idea of expanding it in Washington. So yes, I'm pretty confident that if we don't see it this year, next year maybe the year for full funding on that.
Lisa, to what extent is streetcar ridership holding up? It was so popular early on. Is that continuing?
It is. I just took a look this morning at streetcar ridership, and year over year, it's grown about 100,000 a year.
No kidding.
In total rides.
That's
amazing.
Yeah,
from 2017, 18, and 19, it's been pretty steady.
Let's turn to KCUR. Let's turn to KCI. And how about an update, Ron, on construction of a new single terminal? Are things on track up there?
Well, that's one that I probably have to defer to others on.
Okay.
I work at the Mid-America Regional Council. The terminal project is really being done by the Kansas City Aviation Department, and we've provided some information and input into that project, but it's really not ours, it's theirs, and so I'm not as intimately familiar with it as I probably should be. Hopefully Lisa's got some news on it.
Lisa, how do you see that project progressing?
Well, the aviation department has assured that we are on time, on budget,
but
we know that the timeline and the budget has shifted as we've gone through in this conversation as well. So now that, you know, the projected opening is 2023, and the price tag for this once $1 billion project is closer to $1.5 billion. Right. So we are on time and on budget, but we're not where we started.
Yeah. You just did a story on the talk about a new people mover out at the airport. This would be a way to make the trip from the parking lot to the terminal a whole lot more efficient. What is that about?
Really, that's just, it's in a conceptual phase right now. But if you've ever gone to KCI, especially if you're from Kansas City and, you know, you've got it timed down perfectly, you get to the airport, you walk in, they're ready to board 5 minutes later. But if you park in economy and then suddenly there's no bus there, or you got to wait 10 minutes for a bus, it can throw off your whole travel plan. And so I think with that in mind, the airport's been in conversations with the rental car companies, which their lots are even further out from the economy lots, to see if we can make that whole system more efficient. And so they're launching a study now to see whether it's feasible and what that would look like. Would it be like Orlando, where you've got, you know, this monorail, connecting people? Is it more of a tram that's on wheels? Is it on rails? So they're trying to figure out how to make that more efficient.
One final point here. How about concerns, Lisa, that the project is meeting 35% participation rates at the site for minority and women-owned firms?
It's a big concern for city officials. When they set out to sell this project to voters, they kept using the word, this is going to be a transformational project. And they made sure to set very high levels of minority and women-owned business participation. And right now, those numbers aren't quite there yet. But it also depends on who you ask and how you're calculating those numbers. There's been kind of some in-the-weeds conversations about, well, do we count those minority-owned businesses once they're paid or once they're contracted? And so we are early on in this project. So I'm willing to bet that once construction gets going in earnest, once we start seeing construction happening above the ground rather than just the demolition, that we'll start seeing those numbers and we'll have a better idea of where they are. But it will be crucial that Edgemoor, the developer that's building that airport, does meet those goals.
City officials keep saying, give us time, we're going to get there. That's sort of the message out of City Hall.
Yeah.
Let's turn to buses here. Mayor Quentin Lucas wants to raise spending on city buses by, you know, $8 million a year in order to offer free bus service. Where does that idea, Ron, stand with the city council? What's your sense?
It seems to be very popular. The resolution to study it was passed pretty unanimously. I think what's the challenge will be is where to come up with the $8 to $10 million or so that it'll take to cover that cost. On the upside, I think it has a real opportunity to increasing bus ridership. We talked earlier about the streetcar ridership going up. Bus ridership has actually been declining in the city, and so this is an opportunity to help with that. And honestly, it could provide a real economic benefit to a lot of the riders that may be lower income that could certainly use the money they spend on transit fares on other things like food or housing or health care.
Ron, I don't think you can emphasize that last point enough. I mean, for some families, this could be a real game changer, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that the economic impact of that, I know that UMKC is doing a study of that right now. That's part of what's going into the city's analysis of how to proceed with that kind of an idea. So that is a really significant benefit that it could provide. I'll say on the other side, the Kansas City area, Ride KC, and the ATA have done a lot of work to coordinate the services in Kansas City with the suburban services in Johnson County and Wyandotte County and Independence over the years, and including things like a kind of coordinated fare structure, bringing everything in under the Ride KC umbrella. So one of the things to watch out for with this proposal is how to make sure that we're keep moving everybody along in the same direction and addressing some of the operational issues that may take place if we aren't collecting fares in Kansas City, Missouri, but are still collecting fares in other parts of the region.
Because the city, Ron, does have this reputation as doing a pretty lousy job at actually connecting bus riders to their daily jobs. Is that reputation, is that changing at all?
I think it is. I think that certainly the ATA has done a lot of work on developing new services to provide job access. I think talking about the city's role in this, Kansas City, Missouri provides the lion's share of funding for public transit in the Kansas City metro area. I guess it's upward of 80%. And so they are doing a lot already to provide transit job access. I think the work to coordinate the connections outside of Kansas City, Missouri into job centers and other suburban locations, particularly in Johnson County, Eastern Jackson County, is going to remain a challenging issue that we're focusing on for the next several years.
Lisa, would Kansas City be the first city to try out this whole idea of free bus service?
It wouldn't be the first city, but I can say with confidence it would be the largest American city to try this. There have been kind of smaller ski and college towns that have offered free bus service in Olympia, Washington. They starting January 1st, they started free bus service, zero fare. But it hasn't been tried quite to the scale that we have, that we are here in Kansas City. And I think part of what makes Kansas City the, you know, a good candidate for this kind of, project or going zero fare is that we already have low ridership and we're not spending we're not collecting $30 million in fares. We're just, you know, that $8 million,
right,
while it is a significant amount, is not, when you consider the full city budget, it's not massive.
Any sense of when the free bus service would begin? Is that being talked about?
I think once the budget gets finalized in March, that's the Kansas City, Missouri city budget, then from what I have heard from Robbie McKinnon, who's the head of the KCATA, they're ready to hit the ground running. They're thinking they could do that by the summer.
And Robbie is all for this idea, by the way.
He is all for this. Yeah. He's all for it.
You know, it seems to me that politically speaking, the city is out over its skis a little bit, talking about free bus service. To not come through with this money, Lisa, at this point, I think would be a pretty tough pill for people to swallow.
I think you're exactly right. I think that they've got to find a way to make it happen. Mayor Lucas has said he remains committed to it, but particularly because of all the attention this got in Kansas City and nationally, I think that if they don't follow through, that will be another big story. It won't look good for Kansas City officials.
Okay, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking this morning about the state of transportation. It's part of KCUR's ongoing series, the State of Kansas City series, about several big issues that the newsroom will be following closely throughout the year to come. Okay, from old-fashioned buses to new age Hyperloop, there's this ongoing talk, Ron, about getting from Kansas City to St. Louis in 30 minutes via the Hyperloop. No less a figure than the Speaker of the Missouri House thinks this is the wave of the future. Ron, where does this idea stand? Are we going to see it in 2020?
I don't think we'll see it in 2020, but I think there is some work going on. So backing up a little bit, this is a pretty fast-moving idea. Back in 2018, Black & Veatch conducted a feasibility study with the Virgin Hyperloop One company to look at how well it might work to connect Kansas City and St. Louis and Columbia together with this new technology, which essentially combines a lot of things: pipeline, magnetic levitation, traditional jet fuselage kind of technology,
right,
into a really high-speed surface transportation mode. As you said, the Speaker of the Missouri House convened a Blue Ribbon panel last year that has delivered a report. And so now I think in Missouri, the focus is on helping with developing a test facility. Hyperloop One already has one out in the Las Vegas area. It's a short one. They've used it to test some of the mechanical technologies, but they're looking at a larger facility to be able to actually test it with people in it, to test some of the options for diverting from the main line onto spur routes, how you would get off of the line from Kansas City to St. Louis to Columbia, for instance. And both Kansas City and St. Louis have proposals that have made it through the first round of consideration at Virgin Hyperloop One.
You know, Rod, I can't figure out if this whole Hyperloop talk is really all that serious or not. I mean, the state would have to chip in millions of bucks, tens of millions of dollars to make this happen. This is a legislature that's pretty conservative. This is technology that strikes some people, at least, as kind of pie in the sky. How seriously should we be taking all this talk of Hyperloop?
Honestly, I think it's really hard to tell. I think that someplace in the world is going to get it. I think that the advantages for the Missouri route are that, and the folks from Virgin Hyperloop One will talk about this, is the possibility of using large segments of the I-70 right-of-way that already exists. So that could be a really significant cost savings.
And it's a fairly straight shot from Kansas City to St. Louis,
shot,
and that's good
for
this technology. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think it's something to pay attention to. It is certainly not a done deal.
You know, the Hyperloop, Lisa, would take Kansas City into St. Louis in like 30 minutes. I've got to ask, how much interest is there in Kansas City about going over to St. Louis? I mean, you hear people every day saying they want to go to St. Louis tomorrow?
I don't know that I hear people saying that they want to go to St. Louis every day, but I don't. I think that there is certainly intrigue there in, you know, if you can get from one to the other in 30 minutes, do we become, you know, one metropolitan area? Do we bring essentially the two sides of the state closer to one another? I don't know.
I mean, do you see this as the wave of the future?
I remain a little skeptical.
Mm-hmm. You and a lot of people, by the way, good reporter should,
right,
I guess.
Right. It's a massive undertaking that involves a massive amount of money. And there are so many needs throughout this state that could benefit from, you know, tens of millions of dollars of investment. And I'm just not sure that this pie in the sky is... I'm not sure it's number one on the list, but we'll see. I could be wrong.
Yeah, well, it'd be interesting to see how lawmakers.
And I don't want to be too much of an advocate for it, but I will point out that I think nobody's expectations are that the state of Missouri would pay for the whole freight.
Right.
No.
Right.
Put it
That's
together.
True.
That it would be a public-private partnership. And when you compare the $10 billion cost estimates that we've got right now for the proposed Hyperloop versus the $4 to $6 to $8 billion that it may cost to redo I-70 between the two cities, it's in the same order of magnitude as rebuilding the interstate highway through there. And so that's also a thing that's needed and not funded, and frankly would be less likely to attract any private capital than the Hyperloop might be.
But again, if you're a lawmaker and you're looking at this, these choices of building Hyperloop or rebuilding I-70, which so many people depend on, boy, from a policy standpoint, that'd be a hard thing to walk away from rebuilding I-70, Ron, wouldn't it?
I agree. I'm not saying yeah. that it's an easy choice or a slam dunk, but I'm also saying it's probably not something to just dismiss out of hand either.
Right.
But 2020 is going to be a tough year in the Missouri legislature for any kind of funding proposals. Transportation's been a perennial issue there.
Yes.
We'll have to watch that really closely.
Let's get an update, Ron, before I lose you here, on some other big ticket transportation projects. One of them is progress on a new Buck O'Neill Bridge by MoDOT and the city of Kansas City. This is the old Broadway Bridge, right?
That's right. Yeah. And this is one that the city and MoDOT and Mid-America Regional Council have been working on for several years. I think the news is really positive about that right now with the governors in Missouri. The governor's bond program passed, and that has freed up some funding at the state level to redistribute around the state. The portion of those funds that are coming to the Kansas City area are going to be used on that bridge. And so that's really was the last piece of the funding puzzle to get a new bridge constructed. The state's position and the city's positioned really well right now. Their environmental study on the project is scheduled to be completed later this winter, early spring. And from there, I think the MoDOT is ready to pivot very quickly towards procuring a design build team to actually begin designing and building the work probably as early as this summer. They've hired a project director. They're putting the pieces in place to really move quickly once the environmental study is done.
Ron, how about Mark's work to update the region's long range transportation plan and develop the first regional climate action plan?
So those are taking up a lot of our time at Mark right now. We develop a new transportation plan for the region every 5 years. The current plan will expire in June, so we're working to put a new one in place called Connected KC 2050. It's focused on a lot of different transportation issues, but some of the key ones that we're looking at are how we might look at raising new revenues to fund the transportation needs in the region. We're very financially constrained right now. What are some strategies that we can look to with the transportation system to help with climate change, to adapt to it, and also help mitigate it? How can we provide better job access in the region? How can we maintain the existing infrastructure and transportation services that we have in the best way possible? And so those are some of the topics that we're looking at. Look for some kind of final public outreach on that coming up in the March and April timeframe.
I'm still confused. How does a long-range transportation plan connect to a climate action plan?
Well, transportation contributes in the U.S. at least about a third of the greenhouse gas emissions that are generated. And so it's an area that if we're going to make progress on reducing greenhouse gas emissions, we're probably going to need to do different things with our transportation system. I think it's going to really reinforce some of the things we talked about earlier in the segment about the need to look at alternative ways of getting around than just driving. We're going to need to look at ways of converting the fleet as quickly as we can to electric or non-fossil fuel-based fleets. And we're also going to need to look at ways that we can use transportation and other policy levers to help facilitate more focused growth and development in the region. The kind of pattern of always growing farther and farther out into the suburbs, we think that we need to begin focusing on activity centers and corridors that connect them in the region as an important growth strategy for a variety of reasons, but one of them will be to help reduce our carbon footprint as a region.
Okay, that's Ron Ekelpool, Director of Transportation and Environment at the Mid-America Regional Council. He was joined today by KCUR reporter and afternoon newscaster Lisa Rodriguez. KCUR staff will be following transportation issues closely during 2020, and this sets the table for what our listeners can expect down the road. Thank you both for taking some time. I sure appreciate it.
Anytime, Steve.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ron. After a short break, when we come back, we'll talk with Wes Crenshaw about a new trend these days. It's called adulting. We'll find out what that means. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you want to be the most up to date, go to kcur.org/Kraske and subscribe to our weekly newsletter, Kraske Off Mic. A new one comes out this afternoon. You'll get updates on the shows you missed and a weekly column from yours truly. Sign up now at kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow, the State of Kansas City series continues with an important conversation about public safety and the storylines that KCUR reporters will be keeping an eye on throughout the year. Joining us for that tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, newsflash, lots of young adults in this country say they're not ready to become adults. They say they're not prepared to do the many tasks of daily living required by independent living, like putting together a budget, cooking a meal for four, or operating a manual transmission. They even have a name for it. It's called adulting. And these days, there are actually classes offered around the country to help these young people become, well, full-fledged adults, if you want to call it that. Dr. Wes Crenshaw says this is a trend he's been tracking for at least a decade as adolescence has begun to extend into the mid-20s. He's back to discuss why high schools, colleges, and universities can't do it all alone and why parents need to give kids opportunities for risk, reward, and failure from early on in life. Wes Crenshaw is a psychologist in Lawrence, author of the book Adulting, and a regular guest on this program. Wes, welcome back.
Hi, Steve. Drive a manual transmission? My gosh, I just want to get him to drive.
Yeah, just get him in the car. Yeah.
Even that is an adulting skill that a lot of young people
have put off. I have nephews who have done that and don't want to drive yet. And what's that about?
Yeah, I'm scared to even talk much about that one on the air because we'll have a busload of parents driving over, dropping kids off at our office because it happens so much. But there are kind of two things, and it's just one example, but it's kind of a good illustration. The minute you mentioned it, I thought, yeah, there's one. One issue is that kids are entirely too caught up inside their own inner world. And it's particularly problematic with boys, as we've talked about before. But, video games to boys and Netflix to girls or YouTube. And so needing to go anywhere isn't nearly important enough anymore. And secondly, kids are just so anxious about driving. What used to be seen as a great something that was so desirable for independence that you would overcome your anxieties and work through it is now just seen as a kind of a pain in the butt. And you have to do it if you're forced.
Yeah. Well, there's a word, anxiety, and we've talked about that before in this show, but my sense is from my own students, from my own kids, that anxiety just sort of rules the world these days, and I almost can't believe what I see sometimes.
We recently had, are in the process of transferring our records to a new electronic medical record system that's more advanced. And so as part of that, they wanted to have us list in order the top diagnoses we do. And, you know, I've been on here many times talking about ADHD and ADD, and so I thought that was probably going to be close to the top. By far,
anxiety.
Without question, like probably threefold higher than the next one, which was ADD.
And I gather there's a pretty stout connection between anxiety and kids wanting to master the skills of what becoming a full-fledged adult really is all about.
Yeah. What happens, and you guys did a story in December that I thought was really interesting, got me thinking about doing this show, about kids who were wanting classes on how to be an adult in college. And I have such mixed feelings about this. On one hand, Well, for heaven's sakes, there's some impractical things we teach in college. Let's just teach some practical ones.
Right.
On the other hand, that's pretty expensive at $700 an hour or whatever it may be to go in and to learn some basic things that really should have been established from day one in the family.
How to cook a meal for more than just yourself might be one of those skills you'd learn out of class.
Sure, and of course, today, cooking a meal rhymes with go through the drive-thru. And kids, even just are heating up a Lean Cuisine or something. And there is a renaissance in people in their 20s or late 20s now in, making a more healthy, better meal. This is why you see Sprouts or the Merck and Lawrence coming to fruition. But at the same time, there seems to be a gap where people 16 to 24 are having a hard time making that jump to that sort of thing.
You've actually written a book on this topic of adulting, and the problem is that significant?
Well, I'm dying to read that book, but I actually have not written
it. Oh, okay. I misspoke then.
No, our new book is ADD and Zombies, and that's coming out in a few weeks. But I will say you've given me a good idea this morning.
No charge.
The other one I had talked about writing back a few years ago when we did a discussion of this was I was going to call it The Children Under the Stairs. And sounds creepy, doesn't it?
Right.
And it is for some people. But it is sort of the idea that we're having a hard time launching some kids. And we get about 30 requests a week for different kinds of services at our office. Almost always, there are two of those that are about this problem, that we have people who are just simply not launching. So it isn't just kids in college who are like, how do I run this Instapot or whatever, or that they don't – big one, huge one is not being able to handle finance, which ranges from not being able to keep track of their balance in the bank to wildly, wildly over-borrowing money.
Mm-hmm.
I understand there's a debt crisis for students in our country, but – sorry, Bernie, but there is some culpability that comes with the parent and the child in signing those documents and saying over the course of 4 years, and this is not unusual in my office, I'm going to borrow $100,000 to go to the University of Kansas. And you say, how did you spend that much money? No scholarships and paying an out-of-state tuition and paying your whole way to in your room and board.
Yeah.
So those kind of decisions are adulting decisions that no one is really having a sufficient conversation about.
There are some folks listening to this who are probably shaking their heads and thinking, kids won't launch? They won't venture off into the world? How do you help a kid launch, to use your term for it?
The word I have to use, I use it in the responses to folks who write me, and so if any are listening, here's what I'm going to say. It's brutal. It's absolutely brutal, because if you're in the first year or two and you decide, as we did with my daughter, who has a full-ride scholarship to KU Law School now, in the first 2 years she went to JUCO, she lived at home, and we were helpful in that process. That's not a failure to launch. She was in 15 hours a semester.
Mm-hmm.
But that's helpful. But the people who are 23 and 4 and 5 – and some working at grocery stores is very popular for this crew, or some sort of lesser paying job than will help them get out on their own.
Mm-hmm.
We have, with some frequency, people who smoke a lot of weed in their parents' basement against the parents' wishes.
Mm-hmm.
We have people who are, there's a big controversy about addiction to video games. We'll do that another day. But people who feel their child is addicted to video games is what we refer to in the biz as a behavioral addiction. You become more interested in this joyful thing than you do in the things you need to do every day, like brush your teeth or make dinner or get a job.
And so countering that, overcoming that, you're saying is tough.
It's brutal, because if you're beyond the point where you're really helping your child gain an education, which is cool, if you get beyond that and you become what we refer to as an enabler, I teach everybody in enabling versus beneficence.
Mm-hmm.
Beneficence is giving in a way that is helpful. When you get into the enabling mode, then you begin to have to make decisions that are very, very hard, like you have 3 months to get an apartment and maintain a job, or you're going to the homeless shelter. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that sounds insane.
I've talked to parents who have been in that place.
Probably two a week. Mm-hmm. And immediately I have to warn the parent. And again, we cannot take any more of these cases, so this is not an advertisement. But I tell the parent, your child will threaten to commit suicide. It will happen. Mm-hmm. And the parent writes me back and says, well, that happened last week. Now, these are the most extreme cases, but they are growing in number. I will bet you most listeners at least know someone who has struggled with this. And the difficulty even of just getting the young person into a grocery store, low-cost apartment-level job and residence, it seems overwhelming. I've had people who couldn't keep their young person in the simplest of jobs because right. they want to just basically sit at home and have fun, if that's what you consider fun.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking with Dr. Wes Crenshaw about this trend out there. It's called adulting, this idea that some kids just aren't ready to venture off into the real world and live a life that most of us already know. Okay, parents, fess up here. Will your kids need an adulting class when they leave home? We're curious to find out. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Wes, you first started this trend, spotted this trend a decade ago?
Yeah, easily.
And kids coming into your office?
Yeah. And the worst thing is I began to I thought, well, them millennials, you know, get off my yard, kind of like old guy things. Then I began to read some more historic comment about this. And this is something we probably struggled with since the post-war, and I mean post-World War II mm-hmm. era. This has gotten worse and worse. I think in the 60s, and I, to give my age out, I was born right in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis. So in that generation, I think parents were really trying to do some good things, be more empathic, less violent to their kids. That's right. When the battered child syndrome came out,
right.
Trying to really be kinder people. And
sure.
I'm all about that. But there's a huge difference between being kind and being nice. And kind means you help your child become an adult. And nice means you don't ever make them feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And to give an example of what needs to happen in a short order, you've got to help your kids learn to take risks. And there are a variety of ways to do that, and these need to be helpful, positive risks. But for example, when I was at American Psychological Association last August, I had my son, who was 15 at the time, fly out from Kansas and meet me so we could go do things. He likes Chicago. We go to Second City. We think
right.
that's fun. But so some parents just are scared to let their child travel alone.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I did the same thing with Alyssa when she was 5. Flew her out to D.C.
Wow.
That was unaccompanied minor. Alex, of course, had to fly as an adult. So he gets out there, and that's not a huge risk. But the bigger risk was we were at the McCormick Center, and I pointed at the Field Museum. I said, there it is. I think you can get there. And he did.
Mm-hmm.
He took off, and he rode the buses, and he wandered around the loop. He knows Chicago well enough to know where one needs to be cautious. And he spent 2 days on his own really perusing the city.
And there are lots of parents who are thinking, there is
no
way. What kind of parent are you, right. Wes Crenshaw?
And if you hang out in Chicago as much as we do, you see people his age routinely doing that. It's a normal part of living in the city.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're out in the burbs of Chicago, maybe you don't do that. But in the city, you do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I want him to have that experience, sort of minor, what used to be called urban plunge. But this isn't quite – in urban plunge, you like have him live on the street and live like a homeless person to really get that experience. This
right.
is like, you know, like bougie level of urban plunge. But these sorts of things. I did the same thing with Alyssa in Washington, D.C., put her on that little circulator and let her go to all her favorite museums by herself while I was at APA.
Mm-hmm.
You got to look for those kinds of independence building experiences.
So how does this come up in your conversations with young people? How do you begin to discern that there are issues out there with kids afraid to move into the real world?
So it depends on who's in your office. For the high school folk or the middle school folk, you hope people are talking about this in middle school or younger. That right. helps. So if the it will be the parent coming in, and sometimes they're on the wrong topic. For instance, kids who won't clean their rooms, that has no prediction at all of how somebody's going to be an adult.
Of anything. Yeah, but people, they, sometimes parents make that mistake. They think
they do.
There's a disaster in the offing here. Yeah. Yeah.
That's not the worry. It's the kid who won't drive, or a kid, if you assign the kid the job of washing their own clothes, that's a great idea. That's self-care skill. And the ones who refuse, and we have it happen, and they'll just go to school smelling.
Mm-hmm.
There's a problem.
Then so, their peers start, and maybe that's how they get turned around. Their peers start complaining.
It's definitely a problem. And they will be so resistant to I think they almost smell this idea of, I didn't mean that to be a pun. They sort of sense this idea that they are being asked to do something difficult that may make them more independent. And they're like, no thanks on that. You get a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
Having them prepare a meal, you brought that up. The great way to do that is to have your kid have one meal night a week they have to plan. Another good one, send them to the grocery store. I would pay my kid to go to the grocery store. They don't ask for pay for that. They like the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
But I would pay my kid to do that as an errand for me, not because I can't do it myself,
right.
but it teaches them how to be a consumer. In that situation.
Kids who are reluctant to become adults, that's our topic here today. Our phone number, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Chris from Kansas City, Missouri. Chris, you're on the air with Dr. Wes Crenshaw. Good morning.
Hi. I've done some of this work working with children and adolescents as well. And in my own personal life, I find it doesn't stop when they're 18. I have a 32-year-old son that has really gotten kind of out of line with his attitude and how he treats other people. And part of it's because he's pretty successful, but that's no excuse for bad behavior. And I told him the other day, you need to have a good correcting before you get on to doing other things. I use it other rather rash terms, but I think
I'm with you, buddy. I'm with you.
Parents instill these values in kids, and yeah. I've done my best to do it, but we had a contentious divorce. And secondly, they know they don't borrow a dime, they don't pay back. And I borrowed yeah. a lot of money to get the education, but it all got paid back. It took quite a while, but it got paid. So I want to thank you for the show.
Yeah, appreciate that, Chris.
Chris is my kind of guy. Mm-hmm. He just nailed about three bullet points right there that we were going to talk about. Let's just toss them back at him. So being value-based and saying to your child of any age, I don't think you are treating others correctly or your partner or whatever it may be, is a critical part of all of this. Social interaction patterns, critical, and parents have the hardest time being blunt, like Chris was describing. The other big one he mentioned is money. And mm-hmm. he mentioned one huge aspect of it that I agree on, but there's a broader point. There is never – my mother was a saint, and from when I was 15, I needed a new transmission for my truck. And my mom loaned me the money. In that day and age, she didn't charge me interest. As an adult, she always charged me market interest. I would call the bank and I would say, what would you loan me this money for? And they'd say 5.9%. And that is legally, for tax purposes, what I can my mom can charge me. And that is how we did that. And I never took cash money from my mom that he didn't pay back. I highly recommend parents use this, and you have to start it when they're young so that kids don't know that there's money that you don't have to pay back in mm-hmm. the universe. Second, make them part of the economy. This is so critical, this whole idea that – and bless the hearts of the people in Kansas City, Missouri, and Johnson County – but the number of people we see coming out of here with affluence – who then blow it with their kids. And I will have a conversation, say to the parent says, well, they don't do anything, they're lazy, blah, blah, blah. I say, what do you make them do? Well, nothing. And they have a Jaguar or something sitting out, one of those Lexus SUVs sitting out in the parking lot that the kid drives. And when you say, might there be a connection between you giving them everything and the way they act, then you get a whole story about how I grew up with nothing and
right.
had to make my own way. I sold shoes in the street, and then I built a business out of it, and so on and so on, and now I'm wealthy. I say, why did you deprive your child of this opportunity?
Mm-hmm.
Please, anyone listening who's doing that, try to just stop now.
Yeah.
It's dangerous.
What kind of adulting skills do you see kids struggling with the most when they're in their 20s, Wes?
So we've talked about several of them, finance being the one, you know, eating out. Those two go together.
Mm-hmm.
The 100% of the time when a kid says, I just don't know where my money's going, I just am broke all the time, whether they're on their own or being paid for by a parent, I say, where do you think most of your money is going? And they always say eating out.
Yeah.
So being able to be a, you know, the old major when my mom was in grad school of home economics, wow, what a good major. That's disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to really manage money, manage your food intake, manage your borrowing. You know, there's another credit crisis on credit cards. They get up, the credit card companies show up at the college enrollment day and start signing them up for credit cards.
Yeah.
And wanting too much, to want a new car when you're 22 or 3. I didn't get a new car till in my whole life until probably 10 years ago.
Right, right. Let's go back to some calls here at 816-235-2888. Philip from Midtown. Philip, good morning.
Hi, Steve. By eighth grade, I had all sorts of basic shop skills that I learned in school.
Me too.
And lots of people learn things like cooking and that sort of thing. And that's not taught in schools now to all the kids in by the time they're
that's
in
really
eighth
true.
Grade. You so bet. You're really starting from behind.
Yeah. I suffered through
that's
shop
it.
Clap.
That's all
I appreciate that, Phil. That's a great point. Yeah.
The only reason I didn't take shop class in high school is my dad had a full shop at home. And I have one too. And my kids know how to finish concrete and they know how to install windows and they know how to build a structure. Now, does everyone today need to run out and start building their own addition on their house? No, they do not. But his point is well taken. Learning to do things like change a tire on a car, check the oil, how to buy a car. You would not believe, Steve, because I have really? So many ADHD kids, how many hours I spend working with them on their treatment plan around picking the right apartment.
Yeah.
About which car can they really afford and will it be reliable? But it's so pretty and it's red. No.
Yeah.
No.
Right.
No.
Let's go back to some phone calls here. Let's go to Anya from Olathe. Good morning.
Good morning. I have six children. My youngest is the last one at home. He'll be 16 in a couple weeks and is refusing to do pretty much anything. All my kids have learned to do their own laundry, to cook for themselves, to do everything. He doesn't want to do it. And this morning I was kind in not letting him stay home and lay in bed, but put him out the door to figure out what to do for the day.
You are a kind person.
They don't think so.
I know.
And I think there, you know, these days you have to be creative in discipline because you don't want the state at your door, but even putting him out in the cold, you know, with a 2-mile walk to school. You know, what do you do? But
I appreciate that. Wes?
I got to take a really fast story here. Back in the day.
Make it real fast.
I will. Back in the day, we told the family whose kid wouldn't get up in time to get on the bus that he'd have to walk to school, but it was a rural thing, so they had to drive behind him to be sure he was safe. So the state put him into custody.
Oh,
now,
wow.
We got him out, but this, she's not kidding. People, discipline is not child abuse, and I do know the difference, but if you have to be hard with a kid to get him to listen, like she's talking about there, and you're working with professionals especially, that's not child abuse.
That's Dr. Wes Crenshaw talking about the whole trick of adulting, a growing phenomenon in the country. Wes, always appreciate the good counsel. Thanks very
See
much.
See you next time.
You bet. Tomorrow on the show, the fast food industry was once a means of wealth in Black communities, but it came at a high cost. What that cost was and what it is tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Chelsea Angstrom. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.